Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Hi, my name's Lucy. I'm 13 years old and I don't listen to the Unforgiving 60 because it's really boring. But in a future episode, the kids take over. See you soon. Bye.
And welcome to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
Now, Ben, if you ever thought about implementing an idea that's precious to you, if you ever thought about working for yourself or seizing on a chance, then this episode is for you. Today, we have serial entrepreneur Phil Hayes St. Clair. Now, Phil's armed with a degree in microbiology and an MBA from the Australian Graduate School of Management, but more importantly, he's the entrepreneur's entrepreneur. He mentors startups and he's the CEO and co-founder of numerous new business endeavors. And today we explore with Phil what it takes to be successful as an entrepreneur. We discuss what types of business will be successful and how to source capital. And in true style, Ben, you and I also have Phil test our entrepreneurial skills. And lastly, but certainly not least, we lay down a challenge. Let's get on with the show. And welcome to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
Ben, we are joined today by Phil HSC.
We are.
Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Phil, where are you dialing in from?
Hi, guys. I'm calling from Singapore tonight.
Which is not your place of residence.
No, it's not. I'm here on business for a very quick or a classic trip of 36 hours in and out. And really good to be joining you guys.
Now, we've already talked a little bit about you in the introduction to the show, but it might be beneficial to start with your story up to the point of deciding you want to become an entrepreneur.
Yeah, sure. Well, like most people that know Ben, we went to school together and we ended up going through Army Cadets together. I thought that I would end up retiring a professional soldier, so I enlisted straight out of school. Unfortunately, I ended up discovering, well, the Army ended up discovering I had a bad eye condition, which made me discharge in 2001, just before everything started to kick off. And so I had to find my way into whatever the plan B was, and I didn't really have a plan B. So I ended up working for a bank for a number of years and tried to rust onto the best leaders I could find. And as it turned out, I was pretty good at building products and movements inside big organizations. And at one point I was encouraged to think about doing that on the outside. So I started to build companies and 15 or so years later, here we are.
Oh, wow. Let's rewind a little bit to going to school with Ben Pronk. Who was the better scholar?
I was never a scholar. So but by that definition, he was.
Well, and he's a self-confessed nerd.
Indeed. I mean, we went to a school that had a pretty long and proud sort of military history. And I guess, I got to know him in cadets. I also got to know his brother, Dan, in the cadets as well.
That would have been a brief aside. I remember Dan being in cadets for about half an hour and, in fact, lasting at that school for only about
for another half
minutes.
Hour.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It was funny, though. I mean, it was one of those things. I recounted the story, I think, to you, Ben, a while ago, that the first time I had a chance to sit in the back of a helicopter was as a result of your old man sending a couple of Blackhawks and some Iroquois to a cadet training facility that I was part at. And it was one of those times where I just literally fell in love with the idea of Army aviation, and that sort of gave me the bug. And so that was that's how that course was set.
What about on the sporting field before we close out our school years? Who was the superior sportsman?
I don't really know.
I am laughing because I'm scratching my head to think of a time I would have been found on the sporting field.
I was thinking the same.
Yeah, the school we went to, in addition to a proud military history, had an enormous rugby union history, massive rugby school in southeast Queensland in Toowoomba. And I wasn't a rugby star, and felt very out of place in a school where rugby was a form of religion.
Mm. And Phil,
yeah, I think I feel the same way.
If I ever want to be amused, all I need to do is throw Ben a tennis ball. And watch what happens. Thoroughly amusing. Okay, Phil, sorry, back to you.
I think after I jumped out for my first venture, that was I raised money for my first venture just before the GFC hit. Mm. And it was one of those strangely bizarre situations where you could walk into the room with more than a half-baked idea, but it wasn't too much far past that. And I was given money to go and pursue the idea in a business plan, which was thoroughly undercooked. It was more volume than it was quality, the business plan. I think it was printed out in about 200 pieces of A4 paper. So it looked impressive, but of course, when you got into the nuts and bolts of it, it had very little substance. And over the years, you get very good at knowing what you need to know in order to build something and trying to get to a point where you can fail as fast as you can so that you can either ditch that project and move on to the next one, or you can learn quick enough to evolve the original idea that you had. And so I think it's fair to say I've failed many, many more times than most entrepreneurs, but still here kicking and building interesting stuff. So it's been a hell of a journey. And it's just been a real pleasure to see how guys and girls have come, you know, gone into the military who I knew back in the time where we were all doing that, come out the other side and doing a whole bunch of really interesting stuff. So I'm interested to interrogate what you guys are doing at the Unforgiving 60 later on in the episode.
Oh, we'll get to that. Is it mandatory to fail in order to be an entrepreneur?
Definitely. That is sort of lesson 101. And I think one of the things that a lot of the Australian startup scene have done probably not as well as they probably should have is to sort of look past the glitz and the glamour and the Instagram famousness that comes with people that talk about themselves being an entrepreneur. I mean, the reality is that you will see people who are, you know, dressed in jeans, they've got cool laptops, they're working hard, drinking a lot of coffee, and they talk about all these, you know, vanity metrics of things they're doing and how amazing it all is, when in actual fact, it's very, very long days. You know, my average day is about 17 or 18 hours. Most of that is spent working when it's not with family. And, you know, the travel is not glamorous. The hustling and the rejection certainly is not glamorous. And there are very few occasions where it's, you know, time to really celebrate some of the milestones, because you're sort of built for a constant kind of, I guess, barrage of continuous improvement. And so very often you won't be satisfied with what you've got because the vision in your mind is very, very clear, and there's a long road to it to sort of track down before you can achieve it.
Mm. And Phil, your first venture, the one that didn't succeed, what was it? And why didn't you just give up?
So the first venture was about helping. Well, I'll take a step back. So when I was at a bank, I ended up helping put together a very large charity bike ride. It had hundreds of staff members. We rode around Queensland, raised a bunch of money for scientific research. And it was a fabulous sort of cultural galvanizing kind of exercise for the organization. But when all was said and done, when we put the money towards the beneficiaries, it was very strange to me that the money sort of tended to move into those organizations, but there was very little that we could understand about, you know, what it was that the money was being used for. And it's not an uncommon gripe that people have with, you know, raising money for charities. And there's a whole range of conversations about transparency and effectiveness of not-for-profits. But if you put that to one side, I thought there was a way to help increase that, that I guess, transparency in the process. And so I set about trying to build software to deal with that. And that was back in the time where there was very little research about not-for-profits. There was a lot of money going into it, was the top line. As it turns out, Australians, even still now, only tend to claim about 34 or 35% of the tax deductions they're eligible for based on how much they give. And so there's a whole bunch of really strange incentives at play. As a consequence, people didn't really care too much about what the solution to that problem was that I could see. And that software product that I'd spent a lot of time building, even as a non-software engineer, you know, finding the people, raising the money to make that work, didn't end up working. But I didn't just shut it down because, one, I didn't quite know how to approach that decision at the time. I was pretty green. And there was a lot of pride and identity tied up in, you know, how you go about saying to people, look, I got it wrong. And so that went on for about 5 years. I was working, you know, two jobs to try and keep that venture alive. It was a pretty unpleasant period, but it was one of those ones where it was probably the most formative of my startup time.
The idea of failure and failure being a good teacher, there's a couple of things in there I'd like to unpack. But one of the first ones, you know, there's a lot of, and we spoke with my brother Dan about this concept of, you know, never say die and stick to your idea and, you know, keep iterating. But at what point, how do you know when you're just flogging a dead horse, when the idea's is not going to be good and you should just cut it away and start again? Have you got any reflections on that?
Yeah, look, I think about it often. I mean, I'm in a fortunate position now to have done a little bit of investing too, and I mentor about 45 startup founders on different parts of their journey. And I think the thing that is the key reflection on this is the idea that you can't just stop something because your instinct says to stop. I don't think that's a reason to do it. I think you need to have some degree of evidence about whether you've tested and understood that truly what you're building doesn't have a place to play in the market. Mm. Yeah, there has to be some level of data so that you can objectively say, look, we've given it everything we can, but no matter how many pivots we've made.
But you use the word objectively, and yet so many of these things are very passionate. There's a lot of sunk cost. There's a lot of pride. You mentioned before about that sort of pride and ego and not wanting to say that. How can you get that objectivity in something in that sort of founder startup situation where it's your baby, it's your child?
Yeah, it's interesting, Ben. I think the thing for me, and I think most people have gone through this a few times now, is you need to be able to have an external radar and a feedback mechanism beyond your team and, you know, your own brain to understand if something is working well or not. I think founders, and there's a lot of talk around, you know, the mental health related to founders and how well they're dealing with it and putting themselves under pressure. But I think the reality is that if you can find a way to have feedback coming to you as often as possible, so you can tell if you're actually making progress or not, that's the first major hurdle to overcome as an entrepreneur. And once you have that, you know, it's, you can interrogate and learn off the back of that. If you don't have that, you tend to sort of spend a lot of time in your own mind. And that can be a pretty dark place to play, particularly if all you're receiving is rejection consistently, which is what happens all the time. And so I think, you know, for the most part, I encourage all the founders that I work with and even, you know, our venture, we spend a lot of time being quite data driven. And that's not to say that we make decisions just on data alone. It's about saying that you've set up the frameworks to allow yourself to receive data so you can start to have various inputs to start making decisions. I think that's just a really important point that often gets missed because it's really cool to build stuff and you can build until the cows come home. But when the money runs out and you haven't sort of worked out what you were there to measure, I think that becomes a bit of a missed opportunity.
And do you use that data to celebrate the small victories? We've spoken in a previous episode about Seth Godin's concept of the dip where, you know, all the Instagram sexiness of being an entrepreneur or the shininess of a new venture wear off and you're just into that grind and it may be difficult to see progress. Is that a way, you know, the data points a way that you use to measure progress and celebrate those victories?
Yeah, look, I think that's part of it. But I also think that culturally, from a leadership point of view, it doesn't just, the wins don't just come from data. I mean, you might have a set of meetings or qualitative feedback that comes back from customers or users or whatever else, unexpectedly good take up of something which doesn't actually have much to do with the core product. And given you're in sort of constant rejection mode, you know, one of those small wins can actually really tilt the psyche and mindset of the whole team in a really positive direction. And so what we do, and I've done this at a number of ventures, is that it's sort of up to the founders to send out every week a small wins email. And that goes out sort of Thursday night in preparation for discussion on Friday about, you know, the things that you've seen as a leader have been small wins, because obviously the major issue for most founders is fighting for comms and making sure that people understand where they're at versus all the other stakeholders versus what the team's up to. And when you have a chance to really get those small wins in there, then it gives other team members a sense about what you're seeing. And of course, you give the other team members a chance to sort of ascribe what they believe to be the small wins. And that becomes really useful because you get to understand their perspective and what they're seeing as well. Because as a CEO and a co-founder, you're not going to understand every little logistics point that's going on. And if they've had a win, you want to celebrate that as well. So I think that sort of cultural stuff is really important as well.
So Phil, being an entrepreneur and entrepreneurialism, on Instagram, the hashtag entrepreneur has 52.2 million posts. Why isn't it just the 2019 version of small business?
So the truth of the matter is it should be. So I think it's just grossly ironic that butchers and bakers and hairdressers and taxi drivers have been building businesses, their own businesses, since the dawn of capitalism. And for some reason, we've looked to Silicon Valley, and from the late 90s, we've decided that there is this thing called entrepreneurship, and it is cool, and you should celebrate it in a very different way, and to some extent almost disintermediate, you know, the small business owners that are trying so hard to build out what they have. Essentially, we've just dropped a bit of technology into the top of entrepreneurship, and it's made itself in vogue. So every time I look at an entrepreneur, I see every small business owner doing the same thing because we're grinding to achieve the same outcome. It might just be at a different scale, but that's pretty much where it ends.
Do you have to have a coder on your team to be a startup?
And a hoodie.
And a hoodie.
You definitely need a hoodie and you need a podcast, but you don't need to have a coder.
Now, you've previously described why a startup isn't a small business, and I've heard you describe it as a small business is not necessarily scalable. Is that an accurate description?
It is. I feel as though you're that other person listening to my podcast. So yes, look, it inherently, when we talk about technology in the relation to startups, there is an inherent pursuit to scale an idea and make it impactful for many, many people, both in your country and beyond. Typically, small businesses are there to serve a particular physical audience. And to some extent, the transition or the difference between those two things is you might have a physical storefront. And if you think about, say, the hairdresser that is local to you, they can service, you know, a number of customers. When you think about Slack, for example, a messaging service that just listed on the New York Stock Exchange this past week, they can service many, many, many more people for a much smaller number of people providing the service. So the example in that context, you know, a hairdresser might be able to service, let's say, 100 customers every week. Every Slack employee is able to service more than, say, 4,000 people at any given point in time. And so that's because software is a play and it's a different kind of business model. But there is scale as part of that. And so that's typically what the delineation is. But had we have not had the advent of the internet when we had it, then there's a good chance that we'd all be still talking about small businesses.
Mm. And I mean, I guess that almost talks to our rather flippant point about having a coder on your team, that kind of scalability and the sort of network effects that we're seeing in a lot of these tech startups, you can't get that in bricks and mortar. You can't get that in traditional ventures, can you?
Yeah, it's pretty tricky too. I think, you know, the guys at Atlassian are famous for saying that software is eating the world. Mm. And it kind of is, because, you know, everything that we're doing, what's affording us the opportunity to talk right now is essentially a free software service. And this is more and more part of our days every day. Mm. So I don't think it's going to go backwards, but it's very obvious that people who are doing brick and mortar still have a vital role to play in society at large. So I don't think it's always going to be about software, but I think software plays a pretty big part.
So let's talk, if we could, Phil, about motivations for founders. I mean, the kind of mind-boggling scales, the kind of dollar figures that we're seeing with some of these tech startups come good. Obviously, that's enticing for a lot of people. And you mentioned before the Instagram sort of pictures of the cool entrepreneur, the cool founder. Do you find in your work mentoring entrepreneurs that a lot of people are sort of chasing those extrinsic motivators, the money, the sort of coolness of it, and become sorely disappointed when they find it's a lot of hard work and no guarantee of cash?
I'm sure they're out there. I don't work with those types of people that, you know, sort of operate under the banner of being an entrepreneur just for the sake of the cash.
Because full disclosure, that is why Tim and I are doing it. We probably should have mentioned that earlier.
And I'd love to work with you at some point. I'm sure I can help. I think the thing that is that's really interesting about the founders that I've had the fortune to work with is they've found a very important problem for them that they want to try and solve. And usually there's a very significant kind of event that's caused them to want to solve that problem. And it just, it's one of those things, it's that conviction that allows them to move through what is really difficult and sort of ride the waves of success as well. And it sort of drives a level of humility that I think is really important. I mean, I hear you guys talk about this a lot on your podcast and the people you've had on there as well. I mean, there's an inherent work ethic that they have. They understand it's not going to be all easy. And to some extent, like all of us, we're a bit naive when we first start into this, because if you knew what you're about to get yourself into, you probably wouldn't do it.
Never do it.
But the some of the women I have the fortune to mentor, they're doing extraordinary things inside agriculture. Some of the guys that I'm mentoring doing amazing things in education. And they're all looking at these things from, you know, I want to create a massive impact, but I'm doing it because the problem that I'm obsessed with is something that's had a profound impact on me.
Mm. It's funny you say that. I had the really great pleasure of speaking with a guy called Mike Hofflinger, who was part of Facebook a number of years ago, but had a lot to do with Mark Zuckerberg in his time there. And he, you know, for, and this is post the more recent Cambridge Analytica sort of issues with Facebook, but he reflected always that Zuckerberg was driven by that really intrinsic motivation to connect the world. You know, there were obviously, you know, sort of financial benefits all along the way, but that was this just burning drive for Zuckerberg he really wanted to achieve.
I don't doubt it, actually. I mean, you know, the ventures can take really interesting twists and turns. And I don't think there's anything like a straight road when you're building something from scratch. I mean, there was some timing that worked in Facebook's favor. And, you know, they've made obviously some mistakes along the way. But, I mean, who hasn't? It just happens that what they were able to create was something that was massively scalable. A lot of people wanted to have that, I guess, that longing for connection fulfilled. And Facebook, for all intents and purposes, did it for free. It's one of those sort of things in history that we'll look back on and say, look, it was really a turning point. Obviously, there have been a few shortcomings that have come out of it, but, you know, we're moving to a very different kind of world, and Facebook has sort of facilitated that. So, yeah, it's a pretty interesting story.
So, Phil, the entrepreneurs that stick with it through that piece of failure, which is a necessary part of the journey, why do they want to be entrepreneurs?
Look, I think, one, it comes down to the problem that they want to try and solve. Second, they're usually pretty stubborn. And third, I think this, you know, building companies is a craft, right? It's one of those things where it's tantamount to somebody saying, I'm going to go and become a doctor or a dentist or an accountant. All of those professions require practice to achieve a certain standard. Mm. What I think gets lost in translation here is that to be an entrepreneur, you have to build and fail. And over time, you just get a lot better, like anything with practice. You get a lot better at looking for the signals, reading the plays, hustling more effectively, seeing how to hire, knowing when to fire, all the things, you know, that all comes with practice. And so I think you get bitten by a bit of a bug, I think it's fair to say. You get to see how quickly you can run when compared to maybe working inside a larger organization. And that's intoxicating, because even though you might get it wrong, you can still course correct off the back of that. And I think that's why a lot of people end up becoming sort of serial entrepreneurs, as they call them. You know, you get better every time you try it. And hopefully, if you've done this well in your time, you know, you'll get five or six times at it in life, because on average, it'll take you about 10 years to build a great company. Mm. So it's one of those things that I think it just becomes an obsession.
So I really like the fact that failure is a necessary part of the entrepreneurial journey. And, you know, Ben, I'm looking at you when I say that we... Well, we often reflect that there can be no happiness without struggle. Mm. And that failure is a necessary part of growing a tenacious entrepreneur. But it can't always be failure, can it, Phil? What about the success stories? Can you reflect on some of your success stories, the things that have come out the right way for some of your ideas, some of your startups, some of your entrepreneurial activities?
Yeah, look, I think if I think tactically about some of the occasions where I've been hugely surprised and people have had to sort of remind me that it was a good thing as opposed to sort of being in a constant state of ready to catch the next bad thing. You know, there have been times where I've been raising capital and it's happened a lot quicker than I expected. And that's always a good thing because it's such a distraction when you're in doing it. You're taken away from the team, from your product, from your company. You're there sort of on the road trying to bring money in the door. And when that happens a lot quicker than you would expect, then that's obviously fabulous. But you do wonder how that all happened because the next thing is just around the corner. Other ones include where you've been working on a really big deal, which is pivotal for the company's survival. And at the 11th hour, something just goes wrong. But in the same time that that's gone wrong and it feels like it's all about to fall apart, something just happens in the universe and it's back online. And then all of a sudden, you've closed the deal and everything is fine. And I think it's those kind of things which, you know, keep you driving. I'm sure it's almost 50 bad experiences or problematic failures that lead to every one success. Mm. And hopefully you can accelerate that run rate. But they're the things I often look back on with a fair bit of pride. But I think the thing that I like to reflect on the most is the people that I've managed to convince to come and join a company. So if I call out one in particular, my co-founder at my previous venture called Airshare, I was able to convince my friend and an incredible man and engineer. His name is Ofer. He was just an absolute magician. He left a very well-paying corporate job to come and join us, and we had very little to go on. But he just had an amazing amount of tenacity and just was a very, very amazing human to pull off what he did. And just being able to convince people to come and join your mission and your vision, I think, is one of the most humbling things you can ever do as a founder. So I look back on those pieces. I'm sure I can add, when I eventually exit successfully and financially out of a venture, I can look back on that as well. But that's not an expectation I have. I think I look forward to the time that would happen, but it's not one of those things that's driving me from day to day.
Well, maybe we circle back on that in a little while. In order to leverage, in order to scale, inevitably there has to be capital raising round or rounds. What's the secret to enticing capital into your startup?
That is easily the $64 million question, Tim. I think in all the times I've raised capital, I think a couple of things sort of come out. The first one is that people don't back ideas, they back people. And a person's capacity or a team's capacity to deliver on an opportunity. And the opportunity has to be large. There has to be a business model. There has to be things that make it real and believable. But I think the real thing here is that there has to be a way for the founder to convince and sort of introduce what the future looks like. Because for the most part, people don't have great imaginations. And so in order for people to buy into the idea of putting, you know, post-tax income into a venture, which is very, very high risk, they have to believe that not only is the future you're ascribing, you know, really, really interesting and exciting and game-changing, but it's also something that can be achieved. And so I think the real skill set that comes into play here is being very, very good at storytelling, but more so is backing yourself to be able to do it because no one really knows what's around the corner. And if you're able to answer all the questions that you need to answer of investors, then that makes it a lot easier. I think gone are the days where you could rock up to investors or who claim to be investors, show them a really glitzy PowerPoint deck with an idea with very little traction and ask for money. That used to be what you could do in the US and in other parts of the world in the early 2000s, and to some extent before the GFC as well. But those days are long gone. And so I think the secret sauce really here is have a really compelling view of a problem, know how you're going to solve it, build a team that can help you achieve that objective, and understand how you'll make money from it and grow it so that it can be something that really changes people's lives. If you can do that, and of course that sounds very simple, you'll be fine.
And Phil, you mentioned technology. We know that's been a great binder for recent startups. You also mentioned agriculture and education. Is there any particular industry, sector, discipline, area that investors are looking to specifically at the moment?
Oh, look, I think there are many different investors looking at a whole range of different things, but I think the industries which have not suffered wholesale disruption are very fast approaching a time to be disrupted. And the ones that I'd sort of refer to, and disruption being a good thing, right? Not sort of complete carnage. I think the ones that are most interesting right now are agriculture and healthcare and transport and logistics. I think all of those areas are ripe for that kind of disruption. But there's also still many areas which have not really been touched by the internet. I think we sort of sometimes live in a real bubble where we have our phones, we have our apps, we can connect with each other. But when you look at other countries which have nowhere near the telecoms infrastructure that we have or the disposable income to buy the great phones that we have, they still are lacking for a stable phone line to make a phone call or emergency services to deal with a whole bunch of emergencies they might have in their country or in their city. And so I think there's still a lot of work to be done on sort of backfilling technology into parts of the world that just haven't been able to benefit what we have. And there are a whole bunch of investors keen to back those kind of ideas as well.
Now, Phil, you've spoken a bit about investors. Can you talk to the venture capital scene in Australia? It's patently very different from Silicon Valley, the United States. I'd be interested in your thoughts on the differences and where we're headed.
Yeah, it's funny. I could get in a lot of trouble in this particular segment, but
I don't think anyone listens anyway, mate.
You're very safe.
The thing with venture capitalists is that they're there to make a return on their investment. I think a lot of people sort of forget that when young founders sort of go and try and pursue money, whether it be a small amount like $50,000 or $100,000, right through to millions of dollars. The bottom line is that people who are venture capitalists raise money from other people so that they can deploy that money and make a return on that money for those other folks. Mm. And that's something that is culturally been happening in the US for generations. That's very new in Australia and even here in Singapore and other places. The reality is that we just don't in Australia have the same depth of experience that the VCs in the US have. They've seen a whole bunch of different business models and technologies rise and fall. They've seen a lot of different trends, and I guess we're still playing catch up in Australia. So the overall pool of venture capital available in Australia is relatively small compared to that in the US. One of the venture partners at one of the larger firms in the States, just to give you a sense about the scale, has deployed more capital and has more capital in reserve to follow on with the ventures that he's invested. This one person has more capital at his disposal than the entire venture capital pool in Australia. Hmm. And so when you sort of think about that on a scale point of view, it's tricky. And so that's why you often hear of, software related ventures, moving overseas to where the capital pools are a bit deeper. But I think the reality is that you've just got to be really clear on what the motives are. And I wrote about this week about how incentives are a superpower. Hmm. They are, because when you understand why someone is doing what they're doing and you can predict that behavior, then it's a bit more straightforward about how you would engage with them. But venture capitalists, they're one breed of investor. You've also got angels, as they call them, who are a bunch of people who are private investors who pride themselves. They've probably made money themselves on different businesses. They want to try and pay it forward. That's not donation money by any means. They still want to return, but they have a little bit more patience and a bit more flexibility. And before that, of course, there are friends, family, and other fools who end up backing the ventures very early on in their existence. And so there's a whole spectrum of where you can get money as an entrepreneur. But I think the thing is that, you know, we've had nearly two decades of software-based experience, and so it's becoming harder for ventures to attract customers, and it's becoming harder for entrepreneurs to find capital. Mm-hmm. And that's because, you know, ideas don't cut it anymore and you need to have some traction. Mm-hmm. But if you're able to generate that and it's really interesting, then, you know, usually finding investment isn't terribly difficult.
Okay, so we've spoken about the cultural differences in investors. What about in entrepreneurs? Certainly my experience in the US is that they culturally tend to love to celebrate their entrepreneurs. They love a winner. Whereas in Australia, my view is we're often a little quicker to chop down the tall poppy, you know, and sort of it makes it a bit harder in that respect. Have you got any views on that? Can Australians make good entrepreneurs?
Oh, look, we have. I mean, you can look at Mike Cannon-Brookes and Scott Farquhar from Atlassian. You can look at a bunch of other guys and women as well, you know, Melanie over at Canva. There are huge numbers of Aussie entrepreneurs who have absolutely smashed it out of the park and will continue to do so. And there are some who are coming through even school systems now at the ages of 14, 15, and 16 who are doing amazing work. And they'll continue to really make us proud as Aussies. But I think the thing is that we're still just playing a bit of catch up. But I think what we're developing as well as a bit of a confidence that, you know, we can go toe-to-toe with our American colleagues and our European colleagues as well. And I think it's, you know, sort of game on.
And so culturally, you reckon we can overcome the sort of Aussie knocker mentality?
I think we can in some respect. I mean, it's always good to remain humble. And I think if you were to sort of look at a humility scale between the two countries as opposed to a, you know, somebody who's celebrating, you know, being an entrepreneur, I think that humility stands Aussie in a pretty good stead internationally. So I think we'll never get rid of that. And I think it's a good thing. But, you know, for the most part, we're doing pretty well on the world stage.
Mm. Now, we've spoken a lot about mistakes, and there's that famous truism about failing fast in these kind of ventures. But obviously, you can't just fail and make mistakes. As Tim noted before, you need to learn from them. Have you got any reflections on ways that you can inculcate a reflective sort of practice within your startup so that you can actually capitalize and actually learn those lessons, those hard-won lessons?
Oh, definitely. So, I mean, I've heard you guys talk about it on this show as well. You know, the idea of just stopping and reflecting and allowing your team the space just to pause and essentially do what is an after-action report for them to understand exactly what it is they've just seen. I mean, things move very, very quickly in startup, and you can, it's a bit like how the eye can only see a certain number of frames per second as it processes, you know, images and things in front of it. You know, the same thing is true in startup. And if you end up having what is a really stressful episode for whatever reason, you know, a product launch doesn't go to plan, somebody quits unexpectedly, you don't raise the money and you've got to, you know, put people's wages on freeze and a whole range of things that make it really stressful. The reality is that those kind of events can't go unchecked. And so it's up to really the founders to say, okay, look, let's all just take a minute and pause and allow for us to not only talk about it, but also just to sort of process it. There are a couple of tactics that I've come pretty reliant on to use with that. One of them is just that pause and doing that that sort of after action analysis on a big project or on a release of a piece of software. But there's also the opportunity for people just to decompress as well. And so, yes, you can go out for lunch and, you know, on the odd occasion, sort of just have beers on a Friday afternoon and just let people sort of, you know, have a laugh about what's going on. But I think it's also important to remember that everybody just needs thinking and reflection time on a daily basis. And so for me, you know, between 2 and 4 p.m. every day, no one's allowed to book any meetings across the top of that time. That's just time for me to sort of stop and think about all the things that I've got to try and achieve and what's going well and what's not. And I encourage all my team members to do the same, because there's often just too much going on. And I guess the third tactic there is you need to also give your team space outside of the workplace. So there's an idea of sort of every fourth Friday of the month, we encourage the entire organization, or actually we just do this, we down tools at 12 p.m. on that fourth Friday, and everybody walks out the door, regardless of what your job is. And that's for you to go and spend time doing whatever it is you want to do. It's fully paid, but it's just about getting time back for your own headspace. And that's just about helping people process process the time and space that they need to get across. And so they're the small tactics you can do, because, you know, we're running a marathon here. This is like a 10-year game. You can run at 16-hour days if you want to, but you'll blow up in about the first quarter. So it's about not being as startup-y as some people would have you think. There'll be long days and there'll be shorter days, but on average, you've just got to run a solid race the whole way through.
All right, Phil. The Unforgiving 60, I guess, is Ben and my entrepreneurial project. Would we agree with that, Ben? Or one of them, I should say. We need to probably be tested, Ben. So, Phil, perhaps principle by principle, what's the recipe for success in a side hustle? And perhaps we will respond to each of your principles for success against this particular podcast.
Okay, so I've been trying to think about these principles. And I think the first thing is, have you set yourselves up to learn quickly as you built this podcast? Yes or no?
I am often described as a slow learner. So no for me.
Learn quickly. No, I think the beauty of this podcast for us is that we are learning quickly, just not from ourselves. We're learning quickly from our guests. I think that's been a great success of the podcast.
But are we learning about the business? Are we learning about what we're doing?
The business of podcasting?
Yeah.
Well, you're definitely not. You are the passive partner.
I am dead weight. I will give you that.
So 50% I'd give us.
Yep.
We're learning. Okay. 50% mark on that one.
So one of the things that entrepreneurs often forget about is how to get the product into the hands of people that they think are their target market. So how would you rate yourselves on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being expert marketing and distribution ninjas, of which I know both of you are not, all the way down to 0 being no one knows and it's just you, me, and our respective mothers that listen into this show. Mm. How do you think you've gone in trying to help people learn about this new podcast and what it's all about?
We figured that we'd probably have a receptive audience in the ex-military community. And so one of our initial, expansion vectors was through my brother's Instagram account, fairly healthy following there. And so we press-ganged him into giving us a shout-out and obviously recorded the episode with him. So we were aware of that, his social media following, the kind of people who would probably be interested in following him on Instagram may be interested in what we've got to say. But it has been an evolution, and talking about learning, you know, we think that there's probably a much wider audience. Like the ex-military audience probably know a lot of the military sort of stuff we discuss with some of our guests. And so, I don't know that we're as successful in broadening that out to the wider church who maybe find this stuff really novel.
Mm. I think sales, marketing and distribution, I'd give us a 3 out of 10, Phil. I think it's, you know, a bit like both of our deadlift games, weak. But I will say that our listenership has been fascinating to watch, and some of the feedback we're getting from different walks of life has been incredible. Mm. Naturally, we map the metrics. We know we go global. We go global into parts of the world that we would never think we would, including non-English speaking countries. So that's really interesting. I think also coming back to the guests that we've had on, some of what they've talked about has really resonated. Some of them have talked about topics that largely are a bit taboo, death being one, domestic violence, great example. And the feedback we're getting off the back of that is it's starting to resonate a discussion and open conversations. And in fact, a little segue, I know that you sent us some feedback on listening to one of our episodes, the Rod Bridge episode, and you found it profoundly moving. And you are but one of many that's come back in that way. So I think organically what we do in sales, distribution and marketing in order to promote our podcast is actually very poor. But nonetheless, we're getting to all four corners of the globe and starting conversations that actually are quite inspiring to hear back from.
Yeah, look, I agree. And it's been surprising to me, I think, just listening to content from afar, just how diverse the conversations have been. There's another couple of podcasts that have done a similar kind of thing where it's not general knowledge, but it is diverse and just interesting as a result. And I think you guys are doing a great job on that count. Tell me about how you think you're going in building a community around the brand of the Unforgiving 60, because that's often a very, very important network effect. When you build a really sticky audience and group, they end up becoming your evangelists. And so separate to sales and marketing, how's the community build going? Because that's a very important tenet.
I've got to give a shout out to Tim for this, because he is the driving force behind, I mean, the whole podcast, but in particular the social media side of things, and goes above and beyond in terms of engaging with people through that platform.
That's why we gave it a 3.
Above and beyond his normal capability, which
would have been a 2.
It's a global 3. Yeah. But we are getting, and in fact, we've had a number of wonderful little vignettes, people who we've met through the podcast. I got beaten up by a former world kickboxing champion as a result of the podcast that broke my rib. Story for another time. But we've met some people doing some fantastic things, and I think in some small way have helped them out. Certainly the Greg Wallace connection, the Bodhi Tree episode we did just recently, that has been just a wonderful relationship to develop. And I think that sort of community, and through that things like Army Art and these sort of ventures, I think those will probably be sticky listeners, as in, you know, I think they believe in what we're talking about and some of our guests. And so I think that part that struck me as being very profound.
Love that word community that you use, Phil, too. We didn't know where we were going to go at the start of this venture. There was no business plan. We just thought it was a way maybe we could make a contribution in some small shape and form. In a few weeks' time, we're actually taking a bunch of our guests out for dinner. And we're doing that because we feel it's important that some of them meet each other, which they naturally haven't done. And they're super excited about it. So not just giving them an outlet to tell their story, but also connecting them back to each other. I think to come back to that word community, you know, the community of listeners, I mean, we've been very overwhelmed with the listenership and watching its growth month on month. I think we're in about month 4 or 5 now of the podcast, and yeah, it's been very overwhelming. And dare I say that periodically we go to events where, you know, people look at us like we're the new Hamish and Andy, which we probably are. I mean, let's call a spade, and we would like to throw down to Hamish and Andy that they should have some form of competition with the new Hamish and Andy. Competitions that perhaps we would select, Ben.
Full disclosure, I don't know what events he's referring to.
But no, great question.
I'm writing an email to Hamish right now.
Well, if you do know them, we're throwing down that gauntlet. We will name the competitions, and they should go head to head with a couple of XSAS guys with MBAs. We're very different, though.
Oh, indeed. But I think the interesting thing, actually, about what you've just said here in relation to Hamish and Andy is that those guys, when you listen to them, there is no one in their studio or in their organization having more fun than they're having when they're on air. And you can just tell that. Like, it's authentic, and it's very, very clear. That comes through with you guys too, which is probably, we go through about another 1,000 different, you know, tenets. But the really important thing is that you're having a good time doing it, right? So as you go through all the highs and lows, you wouldn't have known where this was going to go when you first started. No one ever knows where venture is going to go when you first start. But the idea of having a good laugh while you're doing it is often something that entrepreneurs lose sight of. And one of the things that I really enjoyed that I learned, you know, through military, like you guys did as well, is how humor is a free circuit breaker. It's one of those things that we put into, you know, I put into my business and my mentees all the time, and my mentors who get a bit upset at me sometimes, because the reality is that, you know, you're here to do good work, but you're here to have fun doing it. Just don't ever lose sight of it.
I think that's probably one of the big differences. So we've got this amazing luxury that we can do this thing, which, as you've well noted, is an absolute laugh for us.
Mm-hmm. As our accountants hate us for it.
Our accountants hate us.
There's more L than P in our P&L.
It's a loss leader. I like to think. Yeah, I'm not sure what
right. I don't think the income line has got anything on it at the moment.
No. But that's the exact point. We're not relying on this as a source of income, as I imagine many of your mentees would be. And so I guess that brings this big question about monetization. For us, that's not a massive pressure for the podcast. We can enjoy it, we can learn, and we can take our time with all of the financial side of things. But I imagine that must be very different where you've got that looming sort of banks foreclosing on loans and mortgages about to get...
savings running lean.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's one of those things where that's the reality. That's when the rubber really hits the road for an entrepreneur, and usually has more far-flung effects than just the individual. So there are a bunch of people who are sort of transitioning out of, you know, a 10 or 15-year career right now who have young families who have decided to have a crack at building a venture. And I take my hat off to them because it's a brave thing to do when you have commitments. It's one thing to start a venture when it's just you as a single man or woman. You've got very few expenses. You can just see how it goes. And if you fail and you fall off a cliff financially, you can rebuild that. But the stakes get a lot higher when you've got obviously young families and you're one of the key, if not the key, sort of breadwinner. And that's where I think a lot of the stress comes from. So the whole point about learning quickly is that if you are in that sort of situation and you have a limited amount of resources that your partner or you as a family have decided you can expend on this ambition, then you've got to learn as fast as you can. And if it ends up burning up the cash quicker than you expected, then you'll learn a pretty valuable lesson on that. But the reality is that a lot of stress can come from, you know, I'm doing this. It's kind of selfish and a bit indulgent. As a father, I've got two young girls, my wife, an extremely accomplished professional woman. But, you know, I could be doing something a lot less risky day by day and, you know, maintaining a much more stable P&L on the home front. But we've agreed that this is, you know, I'm the best version of myself when I'm building businesses and supporting people and building big ideas out. And, you know, I've just been very fortunate to pick the partner that sort of thinks that. Many probably wouldn't.
All right, Phil, next section is quick questions, quick answers. We're going to give you a quick question. If you can respond with brevity, that would be awesome. You said that you work 17 to 18 hours someday. What do you do for fun?
I play with my daughters and I run.
What's your definition of success?
Having the greatest net positive impact on the world when you pass away.
Definition of happiness?
The smile my daughters give me when I tell them a really bad joke.
And any particular sources of inspiration that you might draw from poetry, books, movies, Britney Spears songs?
Or Christina Aguilera?
That just made it really difficult to answer that. But Rudyard Kipling comes to mind. Oh,
good choice.
Well played.
Good choice. How does one become mentored by Phil HSC?
They call me and show me that they really love what they're doing and they're trying to solve a really big problem.
And why are you running in a weight vest?
It's a condition, Tim. It's a... I don't get enough time to exercise. Mm-hmm. So my sort of 40 minutes in the morning, I just try and make it a little bit more impactful, let's just say. Mm-hmm. So I whacked on one of those. A mate of mine ran in one and I whacked it on and just about died on my first run. But I figured if I practice it, I'd get better at it. And so now it doesn't feel as heavy as it used to be. So still can't do a chin-up in it, but you know, the running's okay.
Is running your outlet?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I think that's kind of it. Oh, beyond writing, actually, I think writing is probably the bigger outlet for me than anything else.
What sort of
if,
writing?
If I don't get, just when I put out my blog post every week, I get very, very upset with myself if I don't nail that 8 a.m. Sunday morning deadline. So it's just, I don't know, it's just become a thing to blow off some steam.
And I've got one final quick question. If I wanted to send a bit of a shout out or some encouragement to a friend, is there any possible way I could do that?
That is such a good question. I'm so pleased you asked. So the poor segue for everyone else who's listening, and Mum, I know you'll love this idea, is that, so there was one thing actually, it came from a conversation I was having with Dan and another person that you and I both know, Ben, David Burt. And we were talking a lot about this idea of resilience and how important it is, but it sort of dawned on me how important the role or the other side of the coin for resilience is, and that's encouragement. And so whenever you have somebody who you, you know, deeply respect give you encouragement, it tends to sort of stick, or hopefully it does stick, and it sort of makes your day a bit better. So I worked with a couple of people to build an online platform that allows you to send unexpected encouragement to people. And so basically the form is that you go online, you put forward a message to the person that you want to send it to, you enter in their mailing address details, and we take care of getting them that message in the post, and they receive that in the post. But when they open it, it doesn't have a sender on it. In fact, it just has the message, and you'll realize it because it's quite personalized to you. On the back of it is a QR code, and so you scan the QR code with your phone and it opens a web page to reveal who the sender is. And immediately after that, it encourages you to pay that forward. So we launched that, I think about 2.5 weeks ago. It's called Be in Motion. And the idea is to sort of be in motion on life and ideas, and to pay forward encouragement. And much like you, when you started the Unforgiving 60, I have no idea if this will work. But it was a novel idea that I kept on getting very strong feedback on. So we'll see how it works. And so far, everyone who's received a card in the mail from somebody who was trying to send them encouragement has been thrilled with it. So it's kind of interesting.
I reckon that's a pretty beautiful thought, and a great way to wrap up our conversation. I will not be holding my breath to receive one from Tim.
I'm sure yours to me will be in the mail tomorrow. Phil, how do people find out a little bit more about you?
Look, you can, everything I think about entrepreneurship lives on my blog at philhsc.com. I'm on Instagram and all the other socials as philhsc. And I have a podcast called Founder to Founder.
And it is beautifully curated, and I actually listened to about 4 hours in a row driving down to a ridiculous triathlon that I did a few months ago. It was fantastic.
Well, that's great feedback. Thanks, Tim.
We've got to stop doing this. Every time we interview someone who's got a better podcast than us, we lose listeners because they go across to the better version. But we do encourage people to check out Founder to Founder, some great stuff. Not just actually for entrepreneurs. I think there's some pretty interesting lessons on leadership, life, inspiration, motivation, resilience, determination, et cetera, that are applicable well outside the startup community. But obviously, if you're in that community, this is gold dust.
Must listen. Concur, Ben. Phil, thanks for being on the show. It's been fantastic to have you.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks, guys. And I will take you, baby. And I've never loved. Awesome, guys. Well, Tim, I know we haven't had a chance to meet yet, but I look forward to doing that one day. I guess
I'm not a nerd, mate, and I can catch a tennis ball.
Meeting Tim is overrated. Do not get your hopes up.
I don't know. How would you describe meeting me?
Regrettable.
But you know, it's good. It's good. But I look, honestly, guys, I do love the humor you guys bring to this show. It's sort of, I think people can be way too serious. You guys have got great chemistry. I'll tweet Hamish tonight and see what he comes back with.
Well, I know we're genuine. We need to challenge Hamish and Andy to some form of competition where they take on the two SAS guys with MBAs.
Got so much to learn.
So baby, let's burn.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60, that's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, you know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.